anesthesia enthusiasts, and welcome to this month's episode of Style Points. If you work in an OR, try to remember the last time you were in a crisis scenario. Who would you want there with you? For a lot of us here at the University of Cincinnati, it's Dr. Corey France, who's joining us to talk about patients with sick hearts who are having non-cardiac surgery. Before that, I'll turn it over to Nate Moore, who will introduce this month's RSI.
Thanks, John. I'm excited to introduce Dr. Krista Salinger, the star of our RSI today. She is taking a quick break from her perioperative care rotation to teach us about IV anesthetics. Let's hear it from Krista.
Now, I know you're all busy juggling OR schedules, pre-op assessments, and the occasional 2 a.m. trauma case. But for the next 5 minutes, we are going to break down IV anesthetics in a way that's quick, digestible, and useful for your everyday practice. So let's get started. What are we really talking about when we say IV anesthetics? These are medications delivered intravenously that induce or maintain anesthesia. They work by depressing the central nervous system, and we use them for everything from induction of general anesthesia to sedation in the ICU. Let's focus on the big four IV anesthetics you'll see in the OR: propofol, ketamine, etomidate, and benzodiazepines. We'll also briefly touch on opioids and dexmedetomidine. First up, propofol. This one's the workhorse of induction agents. Quick onset, short duration, and most patients wake up pretty smoothly afterward. Mechanism, it enhances GABA activity, leading to CNS depression. Clinically, you'll notice it drops blood pressure. This is due to vasodilation and a bit of myocardial depression. So if you've got a hemodynamically fragile patient, maybe a septic ICU transfer, for example, think twice before pushing a big bolus of propofol. Dosing is typically 1 to 2 milligrams per kilogram for induction in adults, but you'll tweak it based on patient factors. And remember, propofol burns on injection. A little lidocaine or using a larger vein can help with that. Next up, ketamine. This drug is like the Swiss Army knife of anesthetics. It works as an NMDA receptor antagonist and has some unique properties. It's both an anesthetic and an analgesic. It also maintains a patient's spontaneous ventilation, while most other induction agents cause apnea, making it a great option in situations such as patients with cardiac tamponade or those predicted to be difficult to intubate and ventilate. Here's the kicker. Ketamine increases sympathetic tone by causing a systemic release of catecholamines. So while most anesthetics drop blood pressure, ketamine can actually support it. This makes it a great choice for trauma patients or anyone who is hypovolemic. However, ketamine also has direct negative inotropic effects on the heart. Normally, the indirect catecholamine release overpowers this, but the negative inotropic effect can be unmasked in a catecholamine-deplete patient. So ketamine may not be the best option in patients with decompensated heart failure or sepsis. Don't forget that ketamine is hallucinogenic at the right dose. Watch for emergence delirium, that funky dissociative state where patients may hallucinate or get agitated. To mitigate this, consider co-administering a benzodiazepine like midazolam. Dosing for ketamine is typically 1 to 2 milligrams per kilogram for induction. Bonus use for ketamine, it can be safely given intramuscularly, which makes it a great option for patients who won't tolerate an IV placement. IM induction dose is 4 to 5 milligrams per kilogram, which is a pretty whopping dose that can take a long time to recover from. So it may be wiser to give a small enough dose so that your patient will tolerate an IV and then complete induction with a different agent. Now, let's talk etomidate. This is your go-to for induction in the patient with a weak heart or hemodynamic instability. It's also a GABA agonist, but with minimal cardiovascular effects. Sounds perfect, right? Well, not quite. Etomidate has two main drawbacks. First, it suppresses adrenal function by inhibiting 11-beta-hydroxylase. After a single dose, this isn't necessarily a huge deal, but prolonged infusions can lead to adrenal insufficiency. Second, myoclonus is pretty common. Those little jerky movements during induction, don't worry, it's not a seizure, but it can be unnerving if you're not expecting it. The typical dosing is around 0.2 to 0.3 milligrams per kilogram for induction. And finally, midazolam. It's a benzodiazepine, and its primary role is sedation and anxiolysis. Mechanism? Once again, it's all about GABA enhancement. Midazolam has a slower onset than propofol or etomidate, so you don't use it much on its own for induction in adults. But it's a great pre-medication or light sedation drug. Be cautious with elderly patients or those with respiratory issues. Benzos can cause significant respiratory depression, especially when combined with opioids. However, midazolam generally does maintain hemodynamic stability. Quick shout out to dexmedetomidine, which is an alpha-2 agonist. It's an awesome sedative, particularly in the ICU, as it doesn't cause significant respiratory depression. And there's EEG evidence that its effects mimic natural sleep patterns. However, you'll see bradycardia and hypotension pretty frequently with dexmedetomidine. These side effects limit its use as an induction agent, since a bolus dose of dexmedetomidine would cause significant hemodynamic changes. And then there are opioids. Fentanyl, sufentanyl, and remifentanil. They're crucial adjuncts for pain control, but aren't traditionally used as the sole agent for induction, outside of the classical cardiac induction, in which high doses of opioids are slowly titrated to effect. But we'll save those for another episode. All right, let's summarize. First up, propofol. It's fast, reliable, but watch out for hypotension. Ketamine, hemodynamic stability plus analgesia. Just keep emergence in mind. Etomidate, perfect for fragile hearts, but beware of adrenal suppression and myoclonus. Midazolam, great for sedation, less so for induction in most cases. Remember, every drug has its pros and cons, so it's all about picking the right tool for the right patient.
Corey France is an assistant professor of anesthesiology at the University of Cincinnati who did a fellowship in cardiac anesthesiology. Whenever a case is particularly complicated or when disaster strikes, most of the people that I know would pick Corey to be there. He brings a calm demeanor and significant expertise to almost any situation he's involved with. Corey, thanks for joining us.
John, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. So first off, why do you think people see you this way? Well, how have you developed this reputation in the time that you've been here to where everybody seems to want you there when bad things are happening?
I think part of it is I'm a giant black cloud. I'm turning gray, but I was and have been for a long time a black cloud. And so just having these terrible experiences, I wouldn't say terrible, but difficult experiences early on in my training, every time I'm on call, seeing it over and over, kind of get used to it to some degree. And then I also am, my pathologies fit well within our specialty. So me being a paranoid, pessimistic person, I'm always thinking, what's the worst thing that can happen? What am I going to do if that thing happens? So you combine that with the fact that I always just seem to turn the corner right when something's happening. I think that would probably be why.
Do you think that you're more of a black cloud or are you more of a storm chaser? Because it seems like you find yourself in those situations more often than a lot of people.
I think early on, I was definitely a storm chaser, especially end of residency, early fellowship. I definitely don't seek these things out anymore. I'm not going looking for them. I do not wander the halls just waiting for stuff to happen. Fair enough, that was me probably 5-6 years ago, though, for sure.
I remember when you started, my first year as an attending was your first year as a fellow. I think we graduated at the same time. And I remember we were always in different cases because you were doing all the cardiac cases, but people always spoke very highly of you, even though I never really got to work with you.
Yeah. I appreciate you saying that. Glad I could be seen that way.
So when we were discussing topics for this podcast, I asked you if there was anything that you were particularly interested or passionate about. You're known as the cardiac guy that everybody comes to. But I wanted to know if you had any particular subsets of cardiac anesthesia that you wanted to talk about on the podcast, but you answered very quickly.
Yes.
You said you wanted to talk about non-cardiac surgery on cardiac patients.
Yes.
Why?
Part of it is a frustration on my end because I see people, we have a lot of residents who graduate and stay on as faculty here. So I see these residents, I watch them grow throughout their years here during training. They get through residency, they're very good at what they do. Then they start as an attending and they're willing to take on these difficult cases, challenging patients. And then slowly, a year or two in, they're kind of shying away from them. And it's not because they've lost their skill set. I don't really know why they do it, but I think when you finish training, you are prepared to take care of the sickest patients. You know, when you finish, especially if you finish residency here, our residents are ready to take care of almost anyone that's going to come through the door. So you need to foster that and continue that, not shy away from it as you kind of go on. You might not be doing the cardiac cases, the valves, the CABGs, that kind of stuff, but you know how to take care of these sick cardiac patients. Don't shy away from it. Use the skill set that you've trained yourself to have and gained from your residency program and continue to care for these sick patients. And also, it's not going to go away. I mean, if you look at our population, our surgeons are no longer declining someone just because of their age or their frailty or their baseline mental status, dementia status. So you're going to have to take care of these patients, whether you're working in a surgery center somewhere sometimes, at an academic center, at a private practice group in the suburbs, they're going to come your way. I would love if people continued to stay comfortable caring for some of these people, because you can't have cardiac anesthesia care for every person that has a bad heart. It's just not feasibly possible.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I've handled plenty of those scary cardiac patients myself over time, and I do my best not to shy away from them. I would be lying, though, if I said that I ask for patients like that.
No, I mean, yeah, there's, don't get me wrong, there are days where I would love to not interact with any of those patients, but like I said, you're just not going to be able to hide from that, I don't think, especially as our field goes into the future, as these people continue to want a palliative hip replacement, right, when they're in hospice, that kind of thing. It's just something we're going to have to do in our field.
I definitely think it's good to have some of these sick patients. I'm sure I have several every week where they have decreased EF or a valve that's bad, or there's some terrible vascular path, something like that. And yep, it's definitely good to be in an academic center where I can keep up my skill set despite not having done a cardiac fellowship.
Yeah.
So let's back up for a second and ask one of my favorite get to know you questions, of course, the who would you ask to dinner question. So you can invite anyone in the world over to dinner. I've had a lot of really interesting responses to this so far. You could invite somebody from the past, from fiction. Who are you going to have over and why?
Yeah, you gave me a heads up about this question, and I thought I would struggle with it. And I sat down to think about it. I was actually thinking about it. I live, if you know the traffic situation in Cincinnati right now, we're going a little off topic for a sec. I live in Northern Kentucky, and my bridge is broke. So I have a long time to think on car rides home. And when I get stuck in bumper-to-bumper traffic, I don't want music on. I don't want to listen to NPR. I just turn everything off. And I zone out and I just follow the car in front of me. And so I had time to think about this. It took me all of about 10 seconds. It would be my paternal grandmother, Joan. She's no longer here. And I thought I would really struggle to find someone of historical interest or something that fit with some of my passions outside of medicine. But no, it would be her. It would be her for sure.
What would you talk to her about?
Just life. She was someone who, you know, helped raise me growing up, and she is probably the most incredible woman I've ever met. And so just getting to talk to her, just interact with her, hear her, some of her anecdotes, some of her advice for stuff I'm dealing with now in the last few years, having her interact and know that I have a kid now. So she, another great grandchild. She had a few before she passed, but just spending more time with her.
I think that's great. And I've asked this question to many people. I ask it on the interview trail, and I get a mixture where a lot of people will talk about historical figures or somebody like that. But there are a lot of people who really wish that they had more time with somebody that they love. And yep, I think that that's a good way to tell what people are thinking and where their values are. So yep, I appreciate you sharing that. What we're here to talk about.
Yes.
Cardiac anesthesia. Can you tell me a little bit about your background in cardiac anesthesia and what sort of made you decide to do the fellowship?
Yeah. I tell our trainees this all the time. There's only a few reasons to do a fellowship in anesthesia. And for me, the biggest reason to do a fellowship is if at the end of the day, you cannot imagine practicing anesthesia without that specific type of anesthesia for the rest of your career, whether that's a 15, 20, 30 year career, then you should do that fellowship. And so there were a lot of things I liked about anesthesia, a lot of some of the subspecialties I did enjoy my time on, but the only time I found myself sitting at home going, man, I really hope I'm doing X tomorrow or Y tomorrow, was I really hope I get put in a cardiac case. And then when I wasn't doing it, I wanted to do it. When I didn't get to do it, I got upset. Like, why didn't they pick me to do that case instead of someone else? And that was the reason I did the fellowship. That's what drew me to it.
Well, that definitely makes sense. That's not how I felt about cardiac cases when I was in them.
And there's like specific things about it for sure. You know, the fact that it is a very, there are very specific steps to the dance in that operating room, right? The communication is very open. It's very fluid, and everyone is part of that team. And it's not a, I'm doing my thing on my side of the drapes, ignoring what you're doing. You know, everyone that's in that room knows what the surgeon's doing at that time, what I'm doing at that time, and just some of the challenges. And again, my pathologies kind of drove me there too. So I don't have to sit there and just do nothing for an hour and a half while someone's dissecting down to a nerve or something. I am always doing something. So I'm always busy using my hands, using my brain, working through something because I don't do well with boredom. I can't focus and just sit there and watch a monitor for an hour and a half. So that room is a good place for me to be.
Yeah, I think that's fair. There's definitely a lot to be said for the team dynamic and the relationship that you build up with the surgeons over time. That's something that I enjoy with some of the cases that I do, whether it's doing an awake cranny with neurosurgery
or OB
or doing something with interventional pulmonology with Rodchenko or somebody like that. It's really nice when you feel like you're in the flow and working on the same team as the surgeon. So that makes a lot of sense. So we're here to talk about patients with cardiac conditions who are not having cardiac surgery. Can you give me an example of a patient archetype that you're wanting to talk about?
Yeah. I mean, we're a trauma center. We get a lot of ortho trauma. So I'll deal with what I know. You get someone who comes in, falls on the ice from the snowstorm recently, broke their hip. They're 80 years old. They know that they needed some kind of intervention on their heart, whether it's their aortic valve replaced or they needed a bypass surgery, but they didn't really want to do it because they don't really do much. They're not active, so they don't really get chest pain that often. Or they know they've needed an ICD because their EF is 25%, never recovered after they got their CABG 5-6 years ago. But now they're here. No fault of their own, and they need a procedure done, and they want it done, and the surgeon wants to do it.
So let's say that a patient like this who has fallen and broken a bone is coming to the pre-op clinic. Let's say we have the luxury of they're not inpatient yet, and we're able to see them in pre-op clinic. Given time for optimization, what kinds of things are we doing in a pre-op clinic? What would you be interested in knowing? What would you be interested in ordering? What would be your process there?
Yeah. I kind of go back to, and with electronic health records, a lot of these people are not new to us, right? So even though we're seeing them maybe for the first time in our department, they are well known to a healthcare system somewhere. So I start with, was this person ever in the hospital and sent home when they were at their best state, their best self? Right. And so if I can go back and say, okay, they were admitted for a heart failure exacerbation, they got diuresed, they got put on goal-directed medical therapy. What did they look like when they left the hospital when those teams felt like they were at their best self? Right. What was their dry weight? What was their functional status? Did they have orthopnea? What symptoms did they have? And then I compare, if I can find that, I compare their best self to how they're presenting today. And then I see, is there any major discrepancy between those two? And that's where I start. That gives me a picture. Is this person where they should be, better than where they were before? Maybe they've even recovered some more with the medical therapy, or are they worse than when they were, quote, at their best? And then after that, I start with functional status and symptoms. One thing I've put more and more stock in as I've seen more patients go through healthcare systems is their functional status. I've seen people with very scary conditions, very severe valvulopathies, really depressed LVRV functions. And the ones that are functional and can do things, and if you read data, it's going to be 4 mets is right around your cutoff. But if they can do a lot of their ADLs, their grocery shopping, they're caring for themselves, they can walk, do an exercise bike maybe for short periods of time, that puts my mind at ease compared to someone who has absolutely no functional status.
For some of our listeners who might not know about METs, can you tell me a little bit about that?
Metabolic equivalents. And I'm from Kentucky. I like to keep things simple. So if you look at and I brought them with me today. We're not going to look through them at all, but I have them here just so I could remember all the societies that are in on them. But the
Corey has a stack of papers here that is
an inch high.
Yeah, an inch high.
The 2024 AHA, ACC, ACS, many, many more guidelines on perioperative cardiovascular testing and management for non-cardiac surgery. Put out again 2024 just recently. But if you look at that, they break it down into metabolic equivalents. And these are all based on historical studies done. you know, right around the time of my birth, really, but four metabolic equivalents of activity. And I liken that to one simple thing: two flights of stairs without stopping, 3 to 4 blocks on flat level ground. And that is that'll get you to a metabolic equivalent that is enough activity that should be raising your heart rate, requiring you to augment your cardiac output and index to keep up with the metabolic demand of your body and your muscles doing that amount of work. It doesn't seem like a lot, but that has good data behind it, that if you can achieve that amount of metabolic activity without symptoms, that's an important thing. Like if you go up 2 flights of stairs and you get chest pain, crushing chest pain at the top, that's not good. But if you can do those things without symptoms, that your risk in the perioperative period is lower. So 4 mets, 2 flights of stairs, and that's kind of where I start when I'm talking about functional status and activity.
I'd be remiss if I didn't mention my favorite unit when I'm talking about metabolic equivalence, which is the lap around Walmart.
Yes.
I usually am asking all of my patients, can you walk a couple of laps around Walmart without getting chest pain or short breath? What if you were pushing a cart? Could you do it?
Right. So, yeah. And that's a good point, because you have to liken it to things that they might do every day, right? If a lot of people have no stairs at their houses, right? Or they live on the 6th floor of an apartment building and they take the elevator, because they're definitely not going to walk up 6 flights of stairs 4 times a day, you know? Another one of mine is, like, our parking garage is downhill from our hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So when patients come into our hospital, even if they're taking elevators in the parking garage to get into the hospital, they have to walk up what is basically over a ramped period. It's not, you know, vertical stairs, but over a flight of stairs. So that's another one I'll use as kind of a surrogate. Hey, did you walk in today? Right. And if they're like, I tried, but I had to stop halfway off that ramp to get a wheelchair. All right. I know where I'm at right away.
Right. I guess if you made it to pre-op clinic, you're cleared for surgery.
Nope. That's the old joke, right? If you put the pre-op clinic on the 3rd floor and have no elevator, if they make it there, they're good.
Okay. So we have seen them. So we know a little bit about them. We know what their metabolic equivalents are. What are some things that we can do preoperatively to optimize these patients? I mean, we know what their valve looks like. We know what their dry weight is. What can we do?
I think a lot of it, unfortunately, there aren't a lot of medical therapies or interventions for sure that you can do, especially with valves. Obviously, the first thing to ask yourself in this situation is, do I have time to do anything?
Sure.
Right. Our prep clinic here, it's gotten better, but you still might be seeing someone who's 48, 72 hours out from their procedure that is time sensitive. We're not even talking about the logistics of this surgeon is going on vacation in a week, doesn't have any block time, any time else, but do I have time to do anything, right? And if the answer is yes, you have time. Okay, in my system, how long does it take me to get this patient in to see a cardiologist who can start them on goal-directed medical therapy and get them on a beta blocker and a mineralocorticoid receptor antagonist, an ACE or an ARB, can get them on an SGLT2 inhibitor, all those things, because we don't usually prescribe them to start a therapy that's going to continue in the pre-op clinic ourselves, right? Our nurse practitioners and us will do some drugs, but that's not our role per se. And if I have time to do that, then it is that referral. And it is, let's get you on the right medicines. Maybe your heart's going to recover some. Do we have time to start them, assess for tolerability, side effects? But then you're talking months, right? This isn't something that's going to take a day or two. So that's in an ideal situation. We don't often have that amount of time.
So some of these patients, like you said, really can't wait, but some of them are really sick too. So philosophically, what does that look like for you? What sorts of things are you considering when you're deciding whether the surgery is urgent and needs to go forward despite the risk, or maybe we need a couple of weeks? What's that decision process like for you?
If I think they are near their baseline optimized state, then it's a question of making sure the patient and the surgeon truly understand their risk and making sure there isn't an alternative therapy or intervention that might be less invasive or risky for the patient to treat that same condition. So that leads us to kind of the risk calculators that you see. And that's kind of where I'll start. And I present that data to the patient, and a lot of them I'll do with them in the room on the computer. I don't like using the computer a lot in the clinic, but that's where I'll pull it up, do their risk calculation using an RCRI, or the Gupta or the ACS one. They're both based on the NISQIP data. And when patients see that and they get to see that percentage chance of stroke, heart attack, major adverse cardiac event, then suddenly they're kind of realizing how serious this is. We're not just talking about, yeah, this might happen and kind of brushing it aside. And so making sure they understand that, and then just having a discussion with the surgeon. Like, this is what their risk is if you look at how they fit into these risk calculators. And then it's a question of, is everyone willing to assume that risk? And if everyone is, then it's a question of, is there anything that I can do short term to mitigate that risk? And we're talking about short term, it's morning of, throughout the procedure, immediately post-op at this point, right? Because we've already decided they might not have time to go see a cardiologist and get started on therapy and wait 3 months for recovery, that kind of thing.
So there are lots of different types of anesthesia that you can do, more than one way to skin a cat. What kind of anesthesia techniques are you looking at when you're dealing with patients who are maybe exquisitely high risk? What do you sort of think about? What do you jump to?
Yeah. If we're going to, I like to put this one in a situation for a patient. So let's say we have a patient with severe aortic stenosis, LVEF is 30, 35% with that, RV functions mild to moderately reduced, and they need a knee replacement.
Okay.
Right. So we have options there in terms of our anesthetic technique. This goes back to me being paranoid and pessimistic. I'm always thinking, okay, this patient, what is going to, if they're going to die on the day of surgery, hear me out on this. No one should die. I don't want anyone to die. But if they're going to die, and this is, again, me being paranoid and pessimistic, what is going to be the etiology of their demise? And in this patient, I'm thinking, okay, it's going to be their aortic stenosis that's going to cause them to have a backup of blood and pressure in their LV because they can't get it across that valve that's going to dilate their heart even farther, and then their LV is going to not be able to actually generate enough pressure. So that downward spiral of aortic stenosis that you see, because you're already part of the way on it with that reduced EFM function. And it's, how do I prevent that from happening? So how do I prevent that downward spiral that starts with building up blood and pressure in the LV because I can't get it across that valve? And is there an anesthetic technique that I could do that could minimize that? And to apply it more broadly to any patient I see, it's, how can I minimize the amount of drugs and impact I have on my patient? Is there a way that we could do this procedure without me involved, right? Could the surgeon use just local? Is there a way that we could do it with a nerve block instead of neuraxial, or neuraxial instead of general? That's my personal philosophy on seeing it. I like to minimize my involvement in a patient if at all possible. The data doesn't support that, though, if I'm being honest, right? If you look at a lot of the studies on anesthetic choice and outcomes after surgery, and even in the guidelines, this giant stack of paper I have over here on my right, they even say there is no real evidence to suggest you do one type of anesthesia, whether that's volatile or TEVA or regional, over another for these patients who have cardiac disease for non-cardiac surgery. To me, keeping it simple, minimizing my impact on them on the day of, that's where I start, right? So knee replacement. Can I do this under regional? Regional alone, probably not, right? Could I do it under neuraxial? Yes. Could I do that neuraxial as a single shot spinal, or a CSE, or a spinal catheter, or just an epidural? You could do it under any of those, but then you start to worry about, if I do a single shot spinal, what level do I need to get up to, right? Do I trust me doing that spinal and managing the spread of the drug to not knock out their cardiac accelerator fibers, to not get them so vasodilated that we suddenly drop their preload, they can't fill that LV, they can't get blood across that aortic valve? And I just think through it like that. Like, if I do this type of anesthesia, will it keep the patient safe and comfortable? Will it allow the surgeon to do what they need to do? And how will it impact that patient's pathology? But at the end of the day, again, I do believe that the type of anesthesia you do does not matter as much as you meeting your hemodynamic endpoints and parameters and goals for that patient.
The paranoid and pessimistic traits that you referred to, this is something that I actually talked a little bit about to Jesse in the last podcast. We were talking about it in terms of being husbands, fathers, that sort of thing. How do you approach having those traits in your real life? How do you make sure that that isn't too dramatically affecting your life at home? That's stopping you from going anywhere and doing anything.
I like to think that it doesn't, to some degree, that I'm one of the few people that, and this is part of the reason why I'm in anesthesia, right? I'm at work, I'm not at work, right? I don't want to take my patients home with me. I don't want to have to worry about long-term follow-up. That's one of the reasons I went into this field. And I do have that ability to kind of switch between me at work and me at home to some degree. I know my wife will disagree, and if she ever listens to this, she's going to remind me of our trip that we did with our nephew and our little kid this summer to Europe.
Oh, I want to hear about this.
Right. I'm always thinking, okay, we're going to lose our passports. Where's everyone's passport? We're going to, you know, forget to catch this train because we got to go from this platform to that platform in downtown Berlin at this time. So we got to make sure that we're hustling from here to here and that kind of thing. And so I do carry some of that with me, and it does impact it. And, you know, I'd like to say that we didn't miss any of our transport. No one ever got lost. We didn't lose any major documents. Nothing bad happened. But I know that it does drive her nuts sometimes, and that does creep into my personal life. And it does, right, to some degree. But usually it's only in those kind of stressful situations, my day in, day out activities. I do a fairly good job of separating work and life.
I think when things get stressful, we probably just default to anesthesia mode, maybe.
Right.
Because that's how we get through our day-to-day jobs when things get stressful.
Yeah.
When it's at home, we sort of do the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. The majority of my time at home is not stressful. Not all my time, but a lot of my time at work is a little more stressful.
Sure.
And so, yeah, it's when that stress level picks up at home that those characteristics in me start to come out.
So let's go back to our patient. What kind of lines, monitors, pulmonary artery catheters, arterial lines, what are we thinking about putting in and why in some of these patients? Does every cardiac patient need a PA catheter?
Yeah. I don't see it recommended as much anymore, and I'm kind of glad for that because I truly believe PA catheters are largely overused in cardiac surgery, even in general. The really only indication for one that I think is a strong indication is undifferentiated shock, right? So the number of times you encounter that truly undifferentiated, I have no idea why this patient is so unstable, are few and far between, right? We put them in for liver transplants here. Well, I know the form of shock in there. It's vasodilatory from their liver disease, and then it's turned into hemorrhagic from the surgery itself.
Sure.
Right? I know how to fix those. There is no question of if it's another form of shock. And then in the cardiac surgery, it's almost always cardiogenic shock, maybe a little bit of vasodilatory sometimes, but so I don't usually routinely want a PA catheter put in. Again, in cardiac surgery for some valve replacements, valve repairs, for some high-risk patients, putting in an LVAD, doing a heart transplant, sure. But outside of that, I don't really see much of a role for using a PA catheter. Other monitors, arterial lines, I used to use them all the time. I would put them in on people. I only did this once or twice, so I don't want people going spreading rumors about me when they listen to this, but I've done it in endo a couple of times for endoscopy procedures. But the real role, I think, for arterial lines is, do I need to have such tight control over hemodynamics that I do not have 2.5 to 3 minutes to wait to get another reading to intervene? Or do I really truly think I'm going to need to be getting labs and objective data from someone on what their base excess is, what their lactate is, what their hemoglobin is so often that I need some point of access to get blood quickly without having to stick them or pause an infusion, draw off a line, that kind of thing. In terms of people with really bad hearts getting, you know, lower risk procedures, patients with EFs 15-20%, severe pulmonary hypertension, severe valvulopathies and endo, I'm not putting art lines in those patients anymore. In EP lab, I'm not really doing it for the AFib ablations in those patients much anymore. And a lot of that is knowing what my backup monitors and modalities are, right? If the proceduralist already has an arterial sheath in and I can quickly access it, then I'm definitely not going to probably put an art line in for a low-risk procedure. If the proceduralist is using intracardiac echo in the EP lab, right, then they can pause what they're doing, flip over, look at the LVRV for me, and I can get an idea of how things are. When they can scan a valve, even less likely to put in an invasive monitor. But the patients that, arms are tucked, that I do need to manage hemodynamics on a more acute basis than every 3 to 5 minutes, those are the patients who I'm probably putting an arterial line in.
I have heard anecdotally that if you really don't like going to endo, then you should just put arterial lines in a lot of your patients and you quickly won't be invited back there.
Yeah. And I think that goes true for any of our roles or rotations that we go on. Like, you don't want to go to IR, just be really inefficient and slow and you won't be in IR anymore. Right.
This is not we're not making any recommendations.
No, yet. This is not advice for people in the future. You decide that you don't want to ever do ECTs. Don't just become really bad at them just so you don't have to do them. That's not the right way to do it.
That being said, when's the last time you've been in endo, Corey?
Every time I'm on call on the weekend, I'm there. And that's about it. And this fits great because it's always, this patient got transferred from Mercy, or sorry, this patient got transferred from an outside hospital.
cut that out.
Yeah. They didn't feel comfortable doing their ERCP there because their EF's 20%, they got pulmonary hypertension, and they're kind of decompensating. So we like to do them. Well, they're in the room now, so. but yeah, no, I get sent over there twice a year. Otherwise, it's only on call.
So how are we managing the hemodynamics in these patients? You've mentioned you might need the arterial line if you're managed again on a hyperacute basis. How are you managing their blood pressure, heart rate, and maintaining cardiac output? What does that look like in some of these really sick patients?
Yeah, this is where I think we do so much preparation and planning in our field that it is a huge pet peeve of mine. It drives me nuts when we identify someone as high risk. Okay, we say this person with their aortic stenosis and their low LVEF, they're going to have surgery, and then we don't do anything different in terms of our anesthetic technique and management, right? So we give them the normal induction dose of propofol. We chase it maybe with some fluids and phenylephrine, and then we're like, oh, geez, that didn't work. We're like, tailor your approach to your patient, know their pathology, know what your drugs are going to do to them, and then I like to be preemptive, right? An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So if I know my patient has a low LVEF, I know I'm going to put them on a volatile that's going to depress their myocardium a little bit more. I'm empirically starting a low dose of an inotrope, right? If I know that what we're going to do is just going to vasodilate them out the wazoo, and that's bad for them because they need all that preload because they have a severe tricuspid regurgitation or mitral regurgitation, then I'm going to vasoconstrict them from the start. Right. And if they have a depressed RV or LV, I'm not going to use a drug that is going to add pure afterload to both of those chambers. I'm going to use a drug that will add afterload, but also maybe help those chambers squeeze. And that's kind of how I look at it. And I started doing that during my fellowship, and I continue to do it today. And this is just a sidebar for people that are listening. I'm a huge believer that you can safely give low to moderate doses of vasopressors and inotropes through a peripheral IV. And I do it all the time. Like all the CRNAs that work with me over in EP, they know I'll start dobutamine at 2.5 with a little bit of vaso. When the pressures come up and the heart rate comes up, then we induce, right? And then you're kind of preemptively bringing them up, knowing that you're going to drop their pressure back down, and you settle out at their baseline state. Instead of starting out at their baseline state, dropping their pressure really low, and then scrambling to recover them.
Yeah, that's something that I tend to emphasize to trainees and people who are taking care of very sick patients as well, is it's usually better to have a little bit of hypertension than a little bit of hypotension. So right. Hypertension, that's something that most people experience on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. You know, if somebody comes up behind them and shouts boo, then they're going to be hypertensive and their body's used to it. But there's not a lot of things that we do in life that cause acute hypotension
right.
That might be a little bit trickier to recover from.
Exactly. Yep.
So what are some pearls for fluid management for these folks? We've talked about optimizing preload, afterload, all that sort of stuff. What are we doing beforehand to try to get these patients to their goal weight, things like that?
Yeah. This is going back to, if they're coming in our pre-op clinic, we have the time. It is, what is your weight now on a standing scale, right? With not your purse on and your giant winter coat and your hat and all this stuff and your 3 cell phones and pager in your pocket, getting an accurate weight on them, comparing that to their dry weight, right? And then working with whoever's managing their conditions to potentially change their diuretic therapy around to get them to that dry weight state. If we don't have that time and I'm seeing them for the first time, again, I like to keep things simple. A cardiologist during my intern year showed me a trick. If you have someone laying supine in bed, and you have their hand, if you can see veins in their hand, mm-hmm. You have them laying supine in bed and their hand is resting on their body. If you lift that hand up, the farther it is above the level of the heart, if those veins stay plump and full on their hand, then they are probably hypervolemic. If you take that hand and they've rested on their body laying supine and they're flat there, they're probably hypovolemic, right? If their veins look slightly full in normal veins when they're laying flat, hand at the level of their heart, they're probably euvolemic.
That's really interesting. I'd never heard anything like that before.
Yeah, and again, it only works when you can see veins in people.
Sure.
Which is not all of our patients.
Yeah, we definitely have some patients that come to us with seemingly zero veins.
Right. But that is one thing I like to use just to get a quick idea. And it's not the most accurate thing in the world. But yeah, if you take someone and you raise their hand above the level of their head when they're supine and all their veins are plump and full, chances are they're fairly volume overloaded. Like if you look at mine right now and I have it, you can't see me, but my hand is above the level of my head. I don't even see any veins in my hand, right? I bring it down onto my lap and you can start to see some fill up.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
Yeah.
I guess I can see it on your other hand. It's been down a little bit longer. Yeah. There you go. So there are all these devices that are attached to people's hearts these days. Complicated devices, LVADs, RVADs, ICDs, pacemakers. What are some of the considerations that you have for these patients who come in for surgery with some of these devices? What's your approach to that? And maybe the patient doesn't even know what kind of device they have.
Yeah, I think the first and foremost, you need to know what that device does. Why is it there? Why did it get put in? And what can it do? What is it doing? And I'm going to separate out into two categories here, because if you look at pacemakers and ICDs, they are very different than some of these mechanical support devices that
sure.
we see.
So, I think most people know when they have an LVAD.
Right. Yep. I agree. So pacemakers and ICDs. Okay. Why was it put in? What does it do or can it do? And then are they dependent on it? Right. So if someone has a pacer and they're dependent on it, I need to potentially treat them differently than if they are paced 10% of the time at home. So it's, again, looking for those interrogation reports, reaching out to the rep, knowing what your surgeon's doing, right? Because most of the guidelines, they've simplified it to say you don't really need to do much for ICDs and pacers if everything is below the belly button, umbilicus. But if your surgeon is working on a knee and you can't put the Bovipad anywhere because they have replaced other knee, replaced hips, all this other stuff, and so they potentially put in a Bovipad, you know, up near the umbilicus somewhere, you might have to intervene on that device because you have EMI, even though they're working below it, right? So know where your surgeon's going to be working, what they're doing, and then am I going to need to do anything with the device? And pacers and ICDs are fairly simple. If they're pacer dependent and there's a risk for EMI because they're working above the umbilicus, you need to put it in asynchronous mode, right? Because they will not pace if that device thinks that your Bovi is their intrinsic cardiac activity. And if they're dependent on it, they will not have a native ejection from electrical activity. Most ICDs, they can pace, and a lot of them, and this is a good point to discuss, they're bi-V ICDs, right? So someone has put one in for cardiac resynchronization therapy long-term. Someone who has an EF less than 40%, who has a prolonged QRS interval, and they want to resynchronize their ventricles so that the RV and LV beat in sync to maximize their cardiac output and index. If they're beating in sync, the RV can generate more blood flow to the LV side, then the LV has more blood flow to generate out to the body. That has been a long-term guideline from cardiology for people with heart failure, low EFs, and wide QRSs. They're going to be paced like 99.9% of the time, right? But they are not necessarily pacer dependent. That just means that if you don't pace them and they're not being bi-V paced for synchronization reasons, they will have a native QRS that does lead to mechanical ejection of blood from the cardiac chambers, but they just might not be in sync with each other in terms of the RV and the LV, and they might have a little bit of a decline in function. That is usually long-term, not short-term, right? So if you take someone's bi-V ICD and you suspend or they don't get bi-V paced because of EMI, they're not going to suddenly go from an EF of 50% to 20%, right? And that's one little thing I've seen and actually caught me a couple of times in the clinic when I was first starting to work there. I'm like, well, we got to put it in asynchronous and all this. And I call the rep and the rep's like, no, we don't. You're crazy. Right? And they explain that to you, right? The reps know a lot about their products. And then the ICD is that you just don't want your patient to be shocked inappropriately. So again, above the umbilicus, I'm putting a magnet on an ICD, which is usually going to suspend its anti-tachyarrhythmia function, the shock. Although most of the new ones, and you've probably seen some of these, they have auto-sense EMI function. They don't do anything to a magnet, right? And the companies firmly believe, and they have FDA approval for this, that their device is smart enough to know the difference between Bovi, radio frequency ablation, lithotripsy, that kind of stuff, and an actual conduction from the heart.
Do you believe that?
I've only been in a situation where that could potentially be a problem about four or five times, and it's worked as it should every time. Do I completely trust it? No, but again, I'm a pessimistic person who's very paranoid, so.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay. But the reps will refuse to turn those off. Like if you call them and you want the anti-tacker function turned off, they just were like, you don't need to do that. We're not doing that.
Huh. Yeah. Interesting. So let's say that we've made it through the case. We have kept them alive through the operation. We've maintained a smooth anesthesia. But now we have to turn it off and send them to an ICU. How are we going to keep them stable going from an anesthetized state where they're not feeling anything to a non-anesthetized state when they're awake? Maybe their heart rate and blood pressure are going up as a pain response. They're sort of coming back to reality and experiencing some of the anxiety that comes with waking up from anesthesia. How are we going to manage the patients who are going through that transition?
Yeah. We didn't talk about LVADs or RVADs, and I don't think we necessarily should for this particular talk, because that's a whole big in-depth discussion about other cardiac devices.
Well, I was going to ask you a follow-up about LVADs in a second, though.
Okay. All right. Well, that could be
a potential
topic for a future podcast. But so you're undoing what you did at the beginning, at the end of the case, right? I'll keep it simple. So at the beginning, they went from their baseline normal walking, talking self to fully anesthetized. I know what my drugs did. I know what I did to counteract that, if it was something that I had to counteract because of their pathology. And now we have to undo that. And ideally, we do that smoothly and not abruptly over the course of 5 or 10 minutes. So before I start that undoing process, because if you're just undoing something, right, I started 2.5 dibutamine and 0.03 units per minute of vasopressin while I was inducing and maintaining anesthesia. Now I'm stopping those drugs because I'm turning my anesthesia off. That's a fairly simple thing to do. You can just stop them. You can wean it over 5 minutes or so, half the dibutamine, wait 3 minutes, and then turn it off again as your volatile gets lower and lower and lower. But the bigger question is, did I or did the proceduralist do something that I need to keep in mind when I am thinking about undoing the things that I did? And an example of this is in the EP lab. You know, maybe they did an ablation and they end up giving 3 liters of crystalloid through their catheters during ablation in someone with an EF of 20%. Well, in that patient, I can undo what I did, but that doesn't get rid of the fact that they might be grossly volume overloaded now because of what the proceduralist had to do during their procedure. Or in the knee replacement in someone with really bad aortic stenosis and a low LVF. Well, I can undo what I did if I started a vasopressor before I induced them to maintain their afterload so that they didn't get ischemic and have trouble ejecting across that stenotic valve. But if I do that and the surgeon lost 2 liters of blood during the knee replacement and they don't have that preload anymore, it doesn't matter if I decrease that afterload, my volatile comes off. They're not going to be able to generate it because they don't have the volume to anyway. They don't have enough to fill the LV to generate a pressure to overcome that. So if your proceduralist has done something that doesn't allow you to undo what you did, you don't undo it. And I think that's a very important thing. You might come in with the best intentions and plans. This patient was coming for an AFib ablation. They're supposed to go home at the end of the day. Well, they might need to stay and they might need to be potentially ICU status. And it's assessing the patient for that at the end. And so a lot of times it's an easy thing to do. Again, if your proceduralist has ice, or if you're comfortable putting a probe on their chest real quick and looking at their heart, is their LV dilated out? Does it look pretty close to baseline? Did the surgeon lose a lot of blood and did we account for it? You know, and if so, then you can give it a shot of weaning your drugs as you wean your anesthetic, your vasoactive drugs as you wean your anesthetic, and try to get them to a state where they are back at their baseline. And I think that's an important thing too. When people come in, if they come in walking and talking, that blood pressure, that heart rate, that loading condition is probably compatible with life. So if you can get them to that same spot at the end, then they'll probably be okay. But you have to know what the proceduralist did. And sometimes you can't get them to that state quickly and easily. And you have to change your plan from a simple outpatient procedure to maybe an ICU admission. If someone's borderline, I know I keep it simple. I try to undo what I did. And if they get worse, I redo what I did. Right. And then I say, okay, I tried. This is what happened. We might need to escalate their care. We might need to change the path that they were on in terms of where they go after the procedure.
So let's go back to your storm chaser days for a second. You walk into a room. You don't really know much about the patient except somebody has said they have a bad heart. and the patient is crashing. What is your approach in your mind to these sort of crisis situations that you seem to find yourself in quite a bit?
It is preparing. So if someone, like just say you're peri-arrest, a lot of times you can get someone back if they do arrest pretty quickly, but you have to have the right tools there. So if someone is crashing and we don't have more help in the room, we haven't brought the crash cart in, we don't have pads on the patient, we don't have the drugs that we need if they do code in the room, it's getting those supplies, getting those things ready so that when it happens, you're ready to treat it off the bat. And then after that, it is, well, what has happened so far? Like, you come in, the heart rate is 180, the patient's MAP is 40. What has happened? What did someone do? Well, they just insufflated the abdomen, but they're not sure about their trocar. Okay, well, because before that, you assume they were fine, right? They haven't been this unstable from the start of the case. Usually there's an event, something that happened acutely that has caused this change in patient condition. And then if you know what that last thing was, what that event was, then you can start building a differential of things that it could be that have caused it, right? Maybe that trocar went into a vein and they injected a bunch of CO2 into a vein, or maybe they built up a bunch of pressure in the abdomen and the patient didn't tolerate that from peritoneal stretch and decrease in preload from that pressure. So that's my kind of first thing. Get the supplies in. Again, pessimistic. I assume they're going to code. Get those supplies in the room. And then what was the last thing that happened? How were they before that and what changed? So I can build a differential and start treating.
So let's say that you're a resident or a medical student that's listening to this, and they really think that what you're saying makes a lot of sense to them. Maybe they're really pessimistic as well, and paranoid. What would you recommend that they do in order to walk in your shoes? What kind of resources do you recommend? How would you advise residents and medical students that are interested in pursuing the kind of work that you do?
I think a lot of med students probably don't mind hearing this, but a lot of residents probably don't like hearing this. It's work more. Do more cases, right? Just get more reps. And so I moonlit a ton as a resident. And that just means you're seeing more. You have an opportunity to see a condition, a pathology. You have an opportunity to see some kind of procedural complication that you may not see otherwise. And you seek out those difficult patients, those difficult cases. You don't shy away from them and say, you know what, I'd really just like to do AV fistulas all day today, right? You always push yourself to kind of get exposure, get experience. The more experience you have, the more you're going to be like, I've seen this before. I've seen something like this before, or I encountered this particular complication. I know this pathology as it relates to this, the surgery. That would be thing number one. And I didn't moonlight because that was not why I moonlit at the time. I moonlit because moonlighting gets you paid.
Sure.
but that is a positive thing that came from it. And it, like, if you look at my class, there was a group of us that all graduated together, and there was three or four of us that moonlit a ton, mm-hmm. right? And there was a noticeable difference towards the end of our CA3 year in terms of what some of us were more comfortable with. And it was just because we'd seen more, we'd done more, right? If you do 600 more cases than, someone else throughout the course of 4 years, you're going to have more exposure. And that's why, and residents who are listening to this, I tell them all the time, you're going to learn more your first 2 years out of residency than you probably did during the majority of your residency, just because your exposure gets doubled or tripled, if not quadrupled, right, of what you see.
What kind of style points or points of personal preference have brought you success in your career, both in and out of the operating room?
I think if you look organized, you look like you know what you're doing, and you kind of have a plan and a backup plan, right, because you're a little paranoid, then people are going to have more confidence and faith in you, even if they should or shouldn't. So little things like being on time, keeping your work area clear, being like, well, I thought about this. And so I was thinking, if they insufflate and the patient doesn't tolerate it, I'm going to ask them to go down with insufflation right away, right? Just having thought through those situations. And that's how I started my day as a resident. When I'm setting up my room in the morning, I was thinking what things could go wrong with this case and how I would respond to that, what can I do to avoid it, right? And I'm keeping things clean. I'm knowing my patient. I'm knowing what their labs were, their last test. That way, you're kind of mentally prepared and you're walking through that. And that's similar to, I think, what some athletes and professionals do, is they kind of visualize things, right? If you talk to or you look at interview, I don't talk to athletes or professionals at all, but if you like read interviews with some of these people, they're like, I just would visualize myself, you know, finishing the last 10 miles of this ultra marathon uphill in the mountains, or I would, you know, visualize myself going downhill on the slaloms, and this is what I would be doing. Like if you do that for simple things, like your lap appy on someone, and when you kind of walk through mentally all the steps of that case, induction, maintenance, emergence, all those things, you're kind of mentally prepared for stuff. You're not so surprised when things happen. And so I think that is something that also, again, even if it's not justified, people, when they see that and they see that you have this plan or you responded quickly because you'd already thought about this, everything's not a cluttered mess. It calms everyone else down.
That kind of reminds me of one of the things that I like to ask residents at times, which is, what do you think would be the thing that would kill the patient the fastest right now?
Yes. Yeah.
Corey, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, John.
Thanks for joining us for this month's episode of Style Points. Word of mouth is the best way to spread the word about this podcast. So if it's something you've enjoyed, tell your friends. Giving us a 5-star rating or leaving a comment will also help other people find the podcast. If you leave a nice or interesting comment, I might just read it on the podcast. You're also welcome to email me at stylepointspodcast@gmail.com. Lastly, take a deep breath, open your eyes, we're all done.